This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. While atrial fibrillation is one of the most common types of arrhythmia, there are many other types of heart rate problems that can become an issue if left untreated. So we have in the studio with us today consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist, Dr. Razali Omar from Cardiac Vascular Central KL, to look at the various types of arrhythmia that present a burden to the population, as well as he's going to be sharing some new updates in the detection and treatment of these conditions. If you have any questions, please do call us at 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon, Dr. Razali. How are you today?
Thank you very much. Very well.
So maybe we start with a bit of an anatomy lesson. I think we need to understand how the heart maintains its rhythm before we can understand, you know, what happens when it goes awry. So if you can explain a little bit about that system of the heart rate.
Right. So most people, when they think about heart disease, they only think about the plumbing. Mm-hmm. They get heart attack because that is the commonest form of heart disease that people are aware of. So I always tell patients, if you have a plumbing problem, you call your local plumber. Mm-hmm. But when you have an electrical short circuit in the house, don't call the plumber, call the electrician. Mm-hmm.
So, and that's what you
and that's,
are.
That's what we are. So mm-hmm. we always like tell the patients like, in CVS scale, there's 7 plumbers and there's 1 electrician because plumbing job is what most people need. Mm-hmm. So coming back to your question, which is what I always inform the patient. So when I tell them about their disease, I always tell them about how the heart works electrically. And so the heart has to coordinate its function, and we call it in a very synchronized manner. It has a small little pacemaker cells called the SA node, sinoatrial node, which is located in the right upper chamber called the right atrium. So that SA node, it fires 70, 80 times a minute. Mm-hmm. And of course, it is sort of controlled by the brain. The brain will send information to the SA node whether the body needs the heart rate to be faster or slower, depending on the activities. And once the SA node receives that information, it will then start to fire at a certain rate. That information has to be carried to every cells in the heart. Mm-hmm. So imagine it starts from the right upper chamber. It will then go to all the cells, this information, all the cells in the right side of the heart, and then it crosses to the left upper chamber. Mm-hmm. All this is done within a split second.
Yeah.
And then once all the cells in the upper chamber has received the information, they would then contract simultaneously. That information then now has to go down to the ventricles mm-hmm. via electrical bridge. And there's only one single electrical bridge that connects the upper chamber to the lower chamber. That's called the AV node, His bundle.
Okay.
So all those electrical signals then come down to the AV node. And there's a reason why there's a bit of delay between the conduction from the time of the upper chamber to the lower chamber to give enough time for the upper chamber to squeeze all the blood down to the lower chamber.
Okay.
Now, after about 0.12 of a second, the lower chamber is now activated and now it's time for it to squeeze the blood to the whole body.
Okay.
So all these are via specialized electrical conduction system.
All right. And is there a range that's considered a normal heart rate?
Normal heart rate usually is between 60 to 100. Anything below 60, we call it sinus bradycardia. The word brady means slow. Cardia is heart. So anything above 100 is tachycardia. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to tachycardia, it means fast. Tachy means fast. Heartbeat, it can either be normal sinus tachycardia because you are excited, you are angry,
right.
you are exercising. So mm-hmm. it can go up to 130, 140, 170 even if you are running very, very fast. Mm-hmm. So we have to differentiate that this is normal function of the heart,
okay.
that the heart is beating at 170 versus somebody who is just sitting down watching TV and suddenly the heart goes at 170 beats per minute,
okay.
which is not normal. Then it becomes a disease.
Okay.
Then it becomes a tachyarrhythmia.
So what would be the conditions that would disrupt the normal heart rhythm to cause that kind of abnormal heart rate?
So there are many, many causes. So whenever a patient comes to us and says, I have, usually the word they use is palpitations. So we ask them, what do you mean by palpitations? Sometimes palpitations in the true form is that their heart races away.
Okay.
Very, very fast. And some of my patients describe that they can see their blouse or their T-shirt mm-hmm. moving as well.
Wow.
When they describe that, usually it means it's super fast. It's not normal. So we have to differentiate when they have that. They say, what exactly were you doing at that time? So, and there are many types. There can be fast heartbeat arising from the atrium. We call it supraventricular tachycardia, so mm-hmm. SVTs for short.
Mm-hmm.
And they can be atrial fibrillation, atrial flutter, atrial tachycardia, AVNRT, accessory pathway, many, many. So it's like when a patient tells me, I have an SVT, I tell them, it's like, you are telling me you have a car, but I need to know what car, what model, what's your engine capacity, that detail
okay.
for us to treat you. So which means SVT by itself, it just tell me it's a generic term, but for us to treat the patient, we need to know what exactly, which SVT do you have? Atrial flutter, atrial fibrillation, and all these things are listed. And of course, there is another group of tachyarrhythmias, fast heartbeat, from the ventricles. We call that ventricular arrhythmias. And this usually is more dangerous, mm-hmm. most of them. Some of them are not dangerous, but when doctors hear the word ventricular tachycardia, they always get worried because there is a risk of cardiac arrest or sudden cardiac death.
Mm.
Whereas supraventricular tachycardias, they are usually benign. They usually do not cause cardiac arrest.
Okay. We will go into sort of like try to narrow down into the risks of some of those, especially atrial fibrillation and SVT and ventricular fibrillation. But, you know, going back to the point that you made, if a patient comes to you and just says, you know, I feel palpitations, and you need to break that down.
Right.
So how do you walk them through that process? What is it that you need to find out from them?
Right. So the most important, first of all, is to spend time with the patient. So I spend, you know, for a new patient, at least 30 minutes trying to decipher what they mean by palpitations and the circumstances that brings on the palpitation. And one of the things that is important for us when the patient says the heart rate goes from baseline to suddenly 150 in a split second, it's like akin to like a Ferrari. 0 to 100 miles per hour in 2.3 seconds.
Mm.
So when that happens, usually when they tell that, it tells me that this is something real. And then most importantly, I ask them, how does it stop? They say, oh, it just goes very fast and suddenly within a beat, boom, it goes back to normal. So this history taking is very important. So first of all, we must be convinced. But if the patient say, you know, doctor, I'm very worried because my exam is coming, you know, I've been not sleeping well, I've been taking stimulants, and now I have palpitations. So, so if that is a story, then we know it's probably related to the circumstances. So one is, of course, the history. But at the end of the day, we need proof. It's like people say, you need to catch that Kodak moments.
Mm.
I need to capture the ECG exactly at the time you have the palpitation. That is the challenge.
Mm.
Many patients, when they come to see doctors or they come to the emergency room, by the time they get to see the doctor or by the time they get an ECG done, the arrhythmia is gone. The palpitation stopped. So all the tests will be normal because these are usually younger patients. When we talk about supraventricular tachycardias, they usually occur in young patients who have no other medical problems.
Okay.
So you expect all the tests that will be done on them will be absolutely normal, including blood tests for thyroid function, echocardiograms, stress tests, Holters, all will be normal. So when this occurs many times and the same patient comes to the emergency room many, many times, you can imagine sometimes the doctors will feel that maybe you are stressed out. And some of the patients have even been referred to psychiatrists, thinking that it's more of a stress, anxiety phenomena, or even depression. I have patients who have been having, palpitations for 10, 20 years, have seen 10, 20 doctors, and all the tests were normal, and finally were referred to psychiatrists. The patient themselves were convinced that they have a psychiatric problem and have been on antidepressant until one day the palpitation occurred to for a long time that they finally appear at the emergency room with the palpitation. Right. And finally doctors say, you actually have a problem.
Isn't there a way to improve the protocol for, diagnosing it? Because if, do shed some light on like how often, it has to happen or how long the duration it has to be before it can be considered a diagnosable arrhythmic condition.
So, if you go to a hospital, then obviously the arrhythmia has to be long enough for you to start your car, go through the traffic jam, take a number at the emergency room. That's because you are quite well, you're not collapsed, so you are not triaged as an emergency.
Yeah.
So it has to last long enough. So, and previously, we only have like 24-hour Holter monitoring. Of course, it's good 24 hours Holter monitoring, but if your palpitation doesn't occur every day, then the 24-hour Holter monitoring may be normal. Let's say you have palpitations once or twice a year. It can be very difficult to catch that once or twice a year lasting for 10 minutes. So previously, it was very difficult for us. So we keep on telling the patient, everything, all the tests are normal. Most likely, this is an SVT from your history, and I've excluded all the potential life-threatening conditions. I think, you can either wait for one day, your palpitation is long enough and you come to emergency room, or we can give you an event recorder. Event recorder is what we used to give the patient, something like Holter, but instead of wearing it for 24 hours, they carry with them these event recorders. Whenever they have palpitation, then they will be able to record an ECG, a single lead or three lead ECG. But in most hospitals, they don't have so many of these systems. So we can give it to the patient maybe 1 or 2 weeks at the most. Again, the patients within that 1 or 2 weeks do not get palpitation.
Yeah.
But nowadays, there are more and more devices. For example, Apple Watches, the new Apple Watch. Unfortunately, it's not yet approved in Malaysia. And I hope it's going to be approved very, very soon. But in America, in Singapore even, if you have the new Apple Watch, then you can actually record an ECG.
Okay.
So if you have something on you, and we have at our hospital, I have also advised patients to get the AliveCor Cardia.
Okay.
It's like you buy the system, and whenever you have the palpitation, wherever you are, you can record an immediate ECG. It's like you have your own ECG machine. Of course, it doesn't record the 12-lead ECG. It just records single lead. It's enough for us to determine that you have a problem.
Okay. So you use something like that at the moment you feel an episode of palpitations.
Correct.
Okay.
So, to capture that cardiac moment is not easy. Because it just can be split second. So we need to capture it for us to be able to treat you appropriately. If you were to just give medicine, then it may not be so important because, you can give beta blockers and it will treat most of the SVTs. But in my specialty where I actually want to go in and cure the patient by doing ablation procedure, I need to know what exactly you have before I enter your heart.
Okay. And we will be going into different treatment options as well. And also, trying to understand if you have 1 or 2 episodes a year, does that necessitate undergoing the treatment for a cure, like you said? Or, how do you make that judgment? Who needs to be treated? And who would you watch and wait?
Right. It's a good question. Yeah.
So we will get into that after a quick break. We have Dato' Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL, to talk about arrhythmias. If you have any questions, call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Shaoik. In the studio with me today, Dato' Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL, and we're talking about arrhythmia, heart rate problems, basically, where something happens to your the electrical system in your heart that disrupts what would be a normal conduction rate. And before the break, Dato' Razali talked about. You've already sort of described where different areas of the heart chambers could be affected, leading to different types of arrhythmias. And you've already actually mentioned personal devices, as well as some home use, shall we say, machines that could actually record an ECG. So this will be very helpful for patients who perhaps only have an episode of arrhythmia quite intermittently. And when they come into hospital, if the arrhythmia is not present, the doctors can't pick it up. It's been quite a game changer, hasn't it?
Yes.
These kinds of devices and machines.
Indeed.
Would you say, though, that number one, is there any concern about sort of overdiagnosis, anxiety about overdiagnosis and overtreatment because a personal device, while useful in providing these kinds of data, could it be picking up more than a patient needs to know?
Right. So actually, I think on the contrary, the underdiagnosing or overdiagnosing and giving treatment when it's not necessary is when people don't know what they're treating. And the patient themselves feels very, very stressed out. But these devices allow us to make a conclusion that, look, you have an arrhythmia and you need this specific treatment. Or we can say all that you have recorded is not an arrhythmia. It's like 90 beats per minute and it's sinus tachycardia. You're just a bit anxious. So I think the ability of the device to dichotomize whether the patient has a pathology, has a disease or not, a physiology, helps both the patients and the doctors. I think this is a new era. Doctors have to learn that patients are going to come to see them now and say, my Apple Watch tells me I have an arrhythmia.
Mm.
And then they will show you an ECG strip. And I've seen the ECG strip and it's amazing. It's very clear.
Accurate?
Very accurate for us to be able to make a diagnosis, to know whether the patient has a problem or not.
Okay. And how do you increase the degree of suspicion about arrhythmias in those who can't afford a personal device like these watches?
Right. So I think a cheaper device, like I see a lot of people walking around with their watch in one hand and a Fitbit machine on the other hand. And the Fitbit machine will be able to record a heart rate. And if they say that, you know, I'm just sitting down, resting, and my Fitbit, and I feel palpitation, and Fitbit records 180 beats per minute. So I think that's real. So we will pay more attention when there is some evidence. Because we tell the patient to feel your pulse, for example, and say, what was your heart rate? And most patients say, it's fast, but I'm not sure how much the fast heart rate. But if you tell me that your Fitbit shows your heart rate is 180 or 120, 130, then it's not normal. So we know we can zoom in and try to ascertain what exactly you have. But we know you have a problem.
Okay. And you've mentioned SVT, supraventricular tachycardia. You've mentioned atrial fibrillation. You've mentioned ventricular arrhythmias as well. So, do you want to go through each of these very briefly and talk about what are the risks of each of them?
Right. So in general, we have two types of arrhythmias. Supra means above the ventricles.
Mm-hmm.
So above the ventricle is the atrium. So when we say supraventricular arrhythmias, it is a generic term. It can mean one of the following.
Okay.
So when we say SVT, supraventricular arrhythmias, for sure it's SVT. It can be SVT, AVNRT, AVRT, flutters, focal atrial tachycardia, and atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
So it encompasses all these things.
Right.
So when we say SVT, it's something very generic.
Okay, it's an umbrella term.
It's umbrella. Okay. Similarly, but when we say ventricular tachycardia, which is from the ventricles, then we have to determine, whenever we see a ventricular tachycardia, the first thing we have to ascertain is this life-threatening or not? So it's different. The approach to an SVT is I need to know, once you have an SVT, like the question just before we went on a break, when would you treat the patient if he has one or two arrhythmias of SVT? If you know it's SVT, then the treatment is entirely up to the patient because it's not life-threatening. So we ask the patient, how does this disturb you? The patient say, doctor, it disturbs me because I cannot travel, I cannot do my exercise. Then we say, okay, these are the treatment options, medication or you go for a cure, which is catheter ablation. But when it comes to VT, the first thing we need to do is this going to kill you?
Okay.
So we have to immediately break down into two. Is this VT life-threatening or is this VT not life-threatening?
How do you determine that?
So one of the most important way to determine is do you have a structurally abnormal heart? For example, VT in someone with heart failure, VT in someone with previous heart attack, leaving him with a heart function which is not normal. So VT in a patient with hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, VT in patient with all sorts of things. So which means the first thing we need to do is we need to know, is your heart normal? Echocardiogram, for example, will quickly tell us whether you have a poor heart function or good heart function. It can tell us whether you have a thickened left ventricle, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. It can tell us whether you have many other things. So from the HOCM, from the echo. From the ECG, we can tell, do you have Brugada syndrome? Do you have a long QT syndrome? Mm-hmm. Do you have arrhythmogenic RV dysplasia? There's so many things. Just these two tests alone can sort of exclude a lot of things.
Right.
And then if necessary, we'll do coronary angiogram to see whether you have a significant coronary artery disease, a cardiac MRI if necessary. Once we've determined that your heart is absolutely normal, then we say your VT is actually benign.
Right.
It behaves like an SVT.
Okay, all right. And so when it comes to the potentially dangerous types of VT, they are the most common cause of sudden cardiac arrest. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. And you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, sudden cardiac death or sudden cardiac arrest. And I think BFM about 2 years ago, and we specifically talked about sudden cardiac death. So once we have determined that your VT is occurring in an underlying structurally abnormal heart. For example, a good example is somebody with a heart attack some years ago, and his heart function was affected by it.
Mm-hmm.
And now he has VT. So this VT usually presents itself as a potential cardiac arrest patient. And the patient is lucky he was resuscitated, he had CPR done, or he was in the hospital, or his friends know how to do CPR. So he's resuscitated. So those group of patients, we call it secondary prevention.
Mm-hmm.
For those group of patients, the risk of getting another VT is very high. So the treatment is very specific. But that is only tackling a small proportion of patients. If you wait for a patient to develop cardiac arrest before you treat the patient, you've lost it.
Mm.
The game is to try and identify those at risk for cardiac arrest and institute treatment before they collapse.
Mm.
Because once you collapse, no matter where you are, even in the hospital, you probably will not make it. Correct?
Yeah. And you hear about young people suddenly dying or collapsing or dying from sudden cardiac arrest, especially footballers or athletes. Are those related to arrhythmias like ventricular?
Most of them.
Okay.
Most of them. These professional athletes getting cardiac arrest is big news, but the actual incidence is actually very, very low.
Mm.
In fact, last time, I think when Malaysia had their national service, I think it's no longer
available. No, okay. it's
yeah. We had one or two young guys who had cardiac arrest and sudden death, and when at that time I was at the National Heart Institute, and we actually wrote in to the government to at least do an ECG as a marker.
Some sort of would an ECG be useful as some sort of a screening?
Yes, it is useful to pick up those at high risk. We can tell from the ECG if you have WPW, Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, if you have evidence of left ventricular hypertrophy, if you have long QT syndrome or Brugada syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
It's very uncommon, all these conditions I just mentioned. But if you have them and it's shown in the ECG, we straight away pull you out of the National Service Program and investigate.
Okay. Because, at the end of the day, it comes down to being able to detect the arrhythmia early and intervening before it gets to that point, as you said. So how can we improve that?
So a lot of them is actually the education of doctors themselves. I think 2 weeks ago, we had a very big conference in KL, attended by about 200 over specialists. And these things have been discussed again and again. We have to remind each other that please identify patients at risk for sudden cardiac death.
Mm.
And these are the features and things like that. And then to advise the patient accordingly.
Because at the primary care level, that is where you think that these could be picked up as well.
Yes.
Yeah. We are also, the other thing because you said SVT is common among young patients. Mm-hmm. So can you actually explain a little bit about the risk factors? Who is at higher risk of developing arrhythmia?
Unfortunately, unlike VTs with cardiac arrest, there's no discerning features for SVT at risk. SVTs are usually, you know, they can just come at any time. If you were to see 100, let's say teenagers, and they don't have SVT at that moment, nothing can show us that they are at risk. Mm. So you cannot predict an SVT until it comes.
All right. And that's again coming back to just being more aware and having that, being more suspicious.
Except for WPW.
Okay.
Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome.
Okay.
So Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is obvious in the ECG even before you get their palpitations.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about the treatment options then. You've already mentioned that medications or catheter ablation would be something that can be considered for SVT.
Yes.
So do you want to go through each of those and talk about how do you decide which is the best patient for
right.
either option?
So once we've determined that you have an SVT and we know it's not life-threatening, so we will sit down with the patient and inform them. And it's a sense of, it gives the patient a lot of relief to know that they're not going to drop dead from this SVT. They're not going to get stroke. They're not going to get cardiac arrest. So we tell them, because it is not life-threatening, the treatment is essentially based on how this arrhythmia, this SVT is disturbing you.
Mm-hmm.
If they say it's disturbing them, then we say, okay, then you need treatment. Then the treatment is of two options. Number one, I can give you some drugs, some medication. And we tell them the pros and cons. Medication is relatively easy and safer. It has its own problems. But it doesn't cure you. So if you are 15 years old, they ask me, how long do I have to take this medication? I said, well, for as long as you're alive, which I think doesn't make sense. Now, all of us know, when we are young, there's no way we're going to take medication every day for the rest of our life, isn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Mm-hmm.
So the next option, which I think is the more, to me, I think it is a definitive option because we can cure you. And it's a procedure called radiofrequency catheter ablation. When we first started doing it 25, 30 years ago, it was a big thing. But now after so many years, and I think SVT ablation now carries with it like a risk of less than 1%. The chance of success cure is 99%.
Mm-hmm.
The procedure is about 1 hour. You come in the morning, we do you in the afternoon, but the next day you go home. And I don't see my patients anymore after just one visit after that.
Right.
Because I tell the patient, I want you to know that you no longer need to see the doctor.
Right.
So that gives them, say, now you are no longer, you don't need to carry a card that you have to see CVS, KL. You know, you are cured. So it's up to you. Mm. I don't force them to say that you have to go for catheter ablation. You wait, you decide. You want to take some medicine, I can give you the medicine. But many patients, they come, I say, they have a lot of side effects. They're young. I feel so sleepy. I feel so tired. You know, this medicine makes me giddy because their blood pressure was not high to start with. And then you give them all this medicine will cause the blood pressure to drop. That's when the time is said, let's get rid of it.
Okay. And you also recently started doing cryoablation.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one of the latest advances?
That's for atrial fibrillation.
Okay.
Yeah,
all
that's
right.
Specific for atrial fibrillation. Okay. We've been doing it for the last 6 years.
Okay. Yeah. So then when we come back from the next break, let's look at the treatments for atrial fibrillation. As well as some updates to the treatment and what other advancements that are on the horizon for the treatments of arrhythmia. I have Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL in the studio with me. If you have any questions, call us at 03-7733-2900, WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899 or tweet us at BFM Radio. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Shao Ik. In the studio with me, Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from CVS KL. And we're talking about arrhythmias today, problems with your heart rhythm and heart rate. Before the break, Dr. Razali, you were going through the treatment options for SVT, which is supraventricular tachycardia, a non-life-threatening condition. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk a little bit about treating atrial fibrillation. Now, the last time you were on BFM, you spent the entire show actually talking about that one. But worth revisiting. It is the most common type
it
of...
It is.
Yeah.
You know, when I started doing electrophysiology about 25, 30 years ago, 90% of the patients were SVTs.
Mm-hmm.
But now, it is the reverse. I see more atrial fibrillation in younger and younger patients.
Why is that?
No idea. It is like an epidemic and is seen all over the world.
Right.
And it's like there's a lot of epidemiology publications predicting that by 2050, you have, you know, a quadruple number of patients with atrial fibrillation. We don't know. There's a many hypotheses. Like there are more patients now with metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes, hypertension in the young.
Mm-hmm.
There are patients with sleep apnea syndrome. Those may just be the tip of the iceberg. I think partly also due to the fact that now people are more aware. They go for checkups, annual checkups, mm-hmm. and now with all these devices and
it's being picked up.
Yeah. So maybe, but I think we are seeing a real increase in the number of atrial fibrillation. Mm. So whenever I see an SVT, I'm very happy because SVT is so easy to treat. It just takes 1 hour of my time, and the patient is cured.
Mm.
But atrial fibrillation, it's a bit more challenging.
Okay.
It is not a single extra wire. We have to fix sometimes both the left and the right atrium.
Okay.
So you mentioned a bit about cryoablation. So cryoablation is something that is one of different ways of treatment of atrial fibrillation. We're still doing a lot of point-by-point radio frequency. We call it heat therapy using like fire.
Mm-hmm.
Cryoablation is using nitrogen oxide. So it's like ice.
Right.
So you freeze it.
Mm-hmm.
So the cells will die either you heat it up or you freeze it. Yeah.
Okay.
So cryoablation is something relatively new. It's easier to do it. And it only is for a certain group of patients. It's not for all atrial fibrillation. For chronic atrial fibrillation, cryo may not be very, very ideal.
Okay.
So it's for younger patients who have atrial fibrillation, which is still intermittent. And again, if you do cryo, it's just about 1.5 hours. Patient go home the next day.
Okay.
And about 80% of them will be cured from AF.
Okay. But with chronic atrial fibrillation, what are the challenges?
Chronic atrial fibrillation, the challenges is that most patients, and this is public, this is all over the world, they need more than one procedure.
Okay.
So usually one procedure alone is, and we tell them the patient upfront, if you have chronic atrial fibrillation, one procedure alone is not going to cure you. You probably, if you're going down the road of catheter ablation to get cured, you and I have to shake hands that we probably have to go down this road together. You probably need at least two.
All right. And what are complex arrhythmias? How do you define complex cases? And when would you decide that perhaps more aggressive treatment is needed?
So complex arrhythmias usually is outside the SVT realm. SVTs are considered as for electrophysiologists, SVTs are usually relatively easy because, as I said, we have a lot of experience. So over 20 years,
mm-hmm.
The complex ones are the ones that are challenging to electrophysiologists nowadays. Still, is the chronic atrial fibrillation, not the paroxysmal. Paroxysmal is relatively easy to treat. Those patients that come with chronic atrial fibrillation in heart failure,
mm-hmm.
so you have a double whammy,
mm-hmm.
Patients usually not very stable, and yet every time they get into AF, they go into worse heart failure. And to do AF ablation in a patient with heart failure is very, very challenging. So that's complicated. Patient with ventricular tachycardia, we put in an ICD device, and they get multiple shocks. They are alive because the ICD saved them, but the shocks are not going to, it's not very nice to have. So doing a VT ablation in a patient who has multiple shocks, whose heart function is barely pumping, those are all the challenges.
Okay.
Those are all the, we call it complicated arrhythmias.
Okay. And in the US, they quite recently, I think, had some updates to the treatment of atrial fibrillation. And among them, they recommended catheter ablation for patients with atrial fibrillation and heart failure to lower mortality.
Correct.
And hospitalization.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yes. So those were the first study was called the CASTLE AF study. And it showed that patients with heart failure, if they have atrial fibrillation, compared to medical therapy, catheter ablation was superior in not only reducing the composite endpoints of overall mortality, hospitalization, and heart failure. Following that, there's another bigger study called the Cabana study. The subset of the Cabana study showed, again, those patients with atrial fibrillation in heart failure are the ones who benefited the most. But from the technical point of view, it is the most challenging. Mm. So although the studies were done and shows benefit, but this has to be taken very carefully, because if you are just doing catheter ablation recently and you don't have a lot of experience, don't start doing AF ablation in heart failure. This is one of the most difficult cases to do, and it has to be done in people who are very experienced, centers who are very experienced in doing catheter ablation, particularly AF ablation.
Okay. We have a question here on WhatsApp who says he was your patient. He had SVT and that you did an ablation and said that he would not need to see you again.
There
he does not have the problem anymore.
Yes.
But some of his friends are telling him that it can recur. So he wants to know, is that true?
Well, you should listen to your doctor. with due respect to your friends, I mean, I'm sure they care for you. But if I've done an ablation and I told you that it was successful, and that was a few years ago, if it were to recur, it would have recurred within a few weeks to a few months.
Right.
The fact that you're writing now a few years ago, that means that just go enjoy yourself, get new friends, and enjoy life. Don't go and see your doctor.
Let's turn to
That's the beauty about the treatment, you see?
Yes.
I sometimes see patients, like this patient. I don't know what his name is. I sometimes see patient, and then the patient come to see me. And I said, yes, how can I help you? He said, doctor, you treated me when I was 10 years old. I said, oh, why? So now he's 25. I said, don't tell me. He's come back. No. I was going to get married.
Mm.
So my boyfriend now wants to know whether am I okay? So you know, like sometimes they say, oh, I had a heart problem, heart operation when I was 10. So of course, before you get married, you know, better be careful. You know, so I said, don't worry. So it's sometimes very, very happy. I'm very happy to see those people that I treated when they were 10 years old. And then now I see them in their adult phase, perfectly healthy, perfectly free from their SVTs.
Okay. All right. And that's for SVTs.
Yes.
But of course, you did say that things have flipped now. You're not seeing as many SVT cases. Unfortunately, you're seeing more.
I think there's several reasons. There's a lot more EP units in the country. When we first started in IGN, we were the only center in the country.
Mm-hmm.
So, and as a new unit, we get a lot of SVTs.
Mm, of course.
But now we have a lot more units. Even the government hospital in Serdang, in Penang, in Ipoh, soon to be in Kuantan, they have a lot of centers. So, which means it's now diversified.
Mm.
So, in private practice, like where I am now in CVSKL, the number of patients that I get to see are more complex.
Mm.
They are referred because they need to be seen by electrophysiology. So maybe it's bias. I wish I see more SVTs because it's such a pleasure to treat them.
Mm.
But unfortunately, I'm seeing a lot more complex cases.
Okay. We also have another question on WhatsApp. Just a very quick one. Is it safe to do cycling, running, or other activities when you have an irregular heartbeat?
Depends what you have. So if you have an irregular heartbeat and you are into cycling and running, I would suggest you go and see your cardiologist and get it sorted out.
Mm-hmm.
Because as I said, I mean, you may have like things like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which can lead to cardiac arrest if you were to push yourself cycling or running.
Okay. That kind of brings me to a point. How do you live with the chronic types of arrhythmia and prevent potential complications?
So, I mean, chronic arrhythmias usually is chronic atrial fibrillation because the other types of arrhythmias we can cure.
Mm-hmm.
But once you have chronic atrial fibrillation, and if you are, let's say, 80 years old and above, and you have been very well, we leave you alone. We just make sure you don't get stroke. We give you treatment to prevent stroke, blood thinner, and oral anticoagulants. But if you're happy with your atrial fibrillation, we don't recommend a catheter ablation. But if you are a young man, and I've seen recently, this year alone, I had three young men between the age of 40 to 50 who presented with heart failure.
Mm.
for the first time in their life. One of them even ran a 15-kilometer run just before he collapsed and had heart failure. All three of them presented with chronic atrial fibrillation. Now, you don't get chronic atrial fibrillation overnight, which means they have been having atrial fibrillation, which was paroxysmal intermittent for many, many years without realizing it, developed chronic atrial fibrillation without realizing it until it has taken a toll on their heart. All three of them presented with heart failure.
Okay, all right.
And for this group of patients, just like we talked about just now, we ablated all three of them. And all three of them are now happy, out of heart failure.
Okay. I mean, and over the years, what do they need to keep an eye on?
I think listen to your heart. Make sure that when we don't feel something not right, you know, you need to get it investigated. Feel your pulse rate. If you're not used to feeling your pulse rate, get something that you can afford that can be able to tell that, hey, my heart rate is... Some people even use a blood pressure monitor.
Right, of course.
The blood pressure monitor would tell you, I cannot record blood pressure because they put that ARR. ARR means arrhythmias. Mm. So all these things will sort of tell you, go and see your doctor.
Mm, okay. We have a question from Zaidi on WhatsApp. It's not related to arrhythmia, but I think it's important for us to address it. He says he underwent an angioplasty last year with one stent in his heart and is now on hypertensive medicine and wants to know, will he get a stroke or heart attack in the future after this angioplasty?
Okay, so that's a very good question, Zaidi. The difference between catheter ablation for SVT, for example, and angioplasty is that SVT catheter ablation is a cure.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, like the other patients say, I saw him a few years ago and I say, bye-bye, don't see me anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But once you have an angioplasty, even you had bypass surgery, by the best surgeon in the world, it's not a cure. So Zaidi, you have to understand, whatever you went through is not a cure. Your treatment is just palliation. Mm-hmm. Which means you have a narrowing, a stenosis, which is so bad that causes you symptoms. The doctor put in a stent. But if you are not careful, if you don't take your medicine, you don't change your lifestyle, stop smoking, lead a healthier lifestyle by exercising, by eating well, the disease will come back. So will you get a heart attack in future? Nobody knows. A bypass surgery and angioplasty do not reduce heart attack.
Okay. And
stroke.
Yeah. It's the other changes that you make to your
life.
Right. Yeah.
That's right.
Those kinds of lifestyle changes, how important are they in managing arrhythmias? Addressing obesity?
If it is SVT, no. Mm-hmm. But if it is atrial fibrillation, there are many studies now, particularly done by my colleagues in Adelaide in Australia, where they showed that by putting the patient on a weight loss program, the patients improve in terms of atrial fibrillation burden. So before we even talk to the patient about catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation, we have to go and look at this lifestyle modification. If you are very overweight, we tell you to lose weight first. Otherwise, I do the procedure, it will just come back. If you have sleep apnea syndrome, we tell you to go for the treatment for sleep apnea first. And then if you have diabetes, which is not controlled. So all this we modify first. And then we see how you are with the AF. If the AF is still bothering you, that's the time we go in for ablation. So it's not just ablating everybody.
Mm-hmm.
Ablation plus a more holistic approach. Lifestyle modification, very, very important.
Okay. I want to very quickly touch on the link between things like caffeine, energy drinks, and arrhythmia. What do we know about that?
All this contains caffeine. So, you know, caffeine is a cardiac stimulant. It doesn't cause an arrhythmia if you don't have an arrhythmia. It just triggers it.
Okay.
So if you already have atrial fibrillation or you have SVT, taking this in larger amounts.
Okay.
Just, you know, so patient asks me, he says, oh, you know, doctor, I love coffee. I've not been drinking coffee because my wife tells me I cannot drink coffee. I said, go ahead and drink coffee. Then you find out from yourself, maybe one cup of cappuccino won't cause any problem, but the second cup does. So, you know, limit yourself to one cup.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have a final message about living with or managing arrhythmias?
So I think, this is such a very big topic.
It's
arrhythmias.
Broad, yes.
So I think in general, the message I have is two. Number one is atrial fibrillation. As I said, there are more and more, and I'm seeing very worrying. I see a lot of young patients So I think maybe if all of us can feel our pulse at least once a week or something, and when you see your pulse is very irregular, come in for a checkup. As I said, some patients don't even realize it. If you are into a lot of these sports, you go for marathon running or half marathon, at least go for a checkup to make sure that you're fine before people have collapsed while cycling and collapse while motorcycling. And in those patients who have coronary artery disease, and if you have a heart attack before, ask your doctor, what's my ejection fraction? If my ejection fraction is less than 30%, talk to him about the role of implantable defibrillators.
Okay. Actually, we've just had a question come in on WhatsApp, so we should get to it. May is 63, had a bypass 15 years ago. Now she has atrial fibrillation and water retention in her leg. She wants to know, is it serious?
Yes, it's potentially serious. If you had bypass 15 years ago, that means, and you have AF now, and we talked about just now,
yes.
Atrial fibrillation can actually trigger heart failure.
Yes.
So if you have water retention in your leg, May, that means that you may have symptoms, a signs of heart failure. So you need to go and see your cardiologist soon.
Okay.
And make sure that your heart function is still okay. And is it the water retention related to heart failure, or is it because your medication? Sometimes medication can cause the water retention in the leg, or is it varicose veins?
Mm.
So we need to determine, is it something serious or not? But AF occurring in a patient with bypass, it's always serious.
Okay, all right. And another question, very quickly, Chia wants to know, are there any side effects of taking medicines? I presume he's referring to medicines
For life?
To treat atherosclerosis, because he's talking about cardiovascular obstruction.
So, I mean, it depends what medicine. All medicine have got their own problems, side effects and all that. But if you, just like everything in life, I always tell patients, everything in life is a balance between the benefit of taking something, the benefit of doing something, a procedure or taking medicine, versus the side effects. So if you want something that is perfect, it is in the next world. In this world, there is no such thing as a perfect drug, no such thing as a perfect procedure. Every drug, every procedure, you have to balance between what am I going to get the benefit and what is a potential risk.
Mm.
So all the medicine, if you have a coronary artery disease, significant, and if you get WhatsApp from your friend say, do not take statins because it is a conspiracy theory by the pharmaceutical industry, don't believe them. Change friends. Because if you have heart attack before, or if you have stents before, or if you have bypass, like me, then you need the certain drugs for the rest of your life, because there are hundreds and hundreds of thousands of patients who has been studied over the last 20 years, which has shown categorically it is beneficial.
Mm.
So the problem is some patients or some doctors are giving it in a 40-year-old who have no other medical problem just because his cholesterol is high. That created all this problem, such that those who really need it are not taking it. I have patients who stop taking statins because they say, my friends tell me this is all conspiracy theory.
Okay. The questions are still coming in, so I'm going to quickly try and get through them. This person says he bought a device measuring the PQRS curve. Is it good to use this to check regularly?
I have not heard of a PQRS curve device.
Okay.
I mean, the PQRS curve is actually, what I'm talking about is the ECG. ECG is the P wave, the QRS and the T wave. So unless he says he's measuring a device which measures the ECG, if you have palpitations or you have atrial fibrillation, you can check it. Or you can keep it and just once in a while when you don't feel well, you feel something's not right with your heart, check. I suppose when you say PQRS curve, what he says is something like what we talked about just now in the earlier part, cardia or things or Fitbit.
So just a home use device that you can use to monitor.
I suspect so.
Okay. All right. That's all the time that we have. Thank you very much. That was Dr. Razali Omar, consultant electrophysiologist and cardiologist from Cardiac Vascular Central KL, right here on Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to BFM.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.